Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuvah, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic Congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
I'm finishing up our series today. It is the fourth and final in my series called The Biblical Record, The Natural Record, or Both. And today we're going to be looking at living creatures in the waters, sky and land, and we'll take a look at the creation of humanity and the giving of the Sabbath. So I want to pick this up. We've been talking about it for a number of weeks, and I want to just posit this idea. Is it possible for science to discover facts from nature that contradict biblical interpretations? Think about that. Let me read this again. Is it possible for science to discover facts from nature that contradict biblical interpretations? For example, the church taught that the Bible was clear on the matter that the earth does not rotate, nor does it move around the sun, but rather the sun is what moves along with all the planets around the earth. The late and renowned scientist Galileo begged to differ. And standing on the broad shoulders of an earlier scientist, Copernicus, and armed with his telescope, he pretty much proved that the church was wrong and false in its interpretation of the Bible regarding the universe. The church, think about this, the church accused him of a bold and stubborn heresy. They said that science cannot correct the Bible. It is infallible. Galileo argued that he and science were not infallible and thus could never correct the Bible. He too believed with a perfect faith that the Bible was without error, infallible, and inspired by God. However, he also believed that the Bible was clear in its statements that the natural record is a revelation of facts and truths from the God who gave us the Bible. Therefore, it was possible that science could discover some facts and truths in the natural record that would challenge and even correct a fallible church and her fallible theologians, who, like scientists, can misinterpret their data, i.e. the Bible, from time to time. Correct the Bible? Nope. Correct fallible theologians and fallible interpretations of the Bible? Yes. They apprehended him through the Inquisition, interrogated him, and then convicted him of the damnable heresy that suggested that the earth rotates and is in orbit around the sun. He was condemned to house arrest for the rest of his life, forced to confess that he did not believe what he had stated prior. It took the church and its fallible theologians 300 years to admit that they had misinterpreted the Bible and falsely charged Galileo with heresy. Rule of thumb: theologians are not trained to also be scientists. and thus should not be viewed as experts in that discipline. And scientists who are not trained as theologians should not be viewed as experts in that discipline. However, both are needed. And when scientists and theologians work together, sharing information and refining ideas, we get the best data for interpreting the Bible and the world that we live in. We should never be afraid of what theologians and scientists bring to the table, but open to the truths in both disciplines, looking into both records, the record of the Bible and the record of nature, in our pursuit of truth and the glory of our God who created all things seen and unseen. So let's jump into the last part of my series. We're looking at day 5 and day 6. Actually, we'll include day 7 because I got to wind it up, right? God creates a second time on days 5 and 6. I've already covered this material. Go back and listen to the podcast. But the first time that God creates, quote unquote, is in verse 1, when he created the universe and primordial earth. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Hebrew word for create is bara, B-A-R-A, and means the act of creating something new for the first time out of nothing. That's what the word create means in this passage, in this context. The act of creating something new for the first time out of nothing. By the way, I do not make up the definitions of the Hebrew words like bara, create, and yom, day, but simply restate what are in the lexicons that are written by qualified experts on the Hebrew language. I am not smart enough to do that work, but I can certainly restate what the experts say about that language. Does that make sense? So when you say, I disagree with Pastor Mark on the meaning or definition of that Hebrew term, please understand, please. I'm flattered, but please understand. It's not me that you're disagreeing with, but rather a long train of professional academics who are experts in the field of Hebrew linguistics. The Hebrew word bara, create, found in verse 1, does not show up again until verses 21 and 26 on day 5 and day 6. This is intriguing for a number of very important reasons. Now I'm going to read the account of day 5 and 6 and the Genesis account of creation and then make some observations. Again, this is just a brief overview of the creation texts, primarily found in Genesis. I don't have time to develop the ones in Psalms or Job or in other places in the Word. But nonetheless, we'll do what we can to try to give a brief overview. Day 5, transparent skies, observable solar days and seasons, land masses and a water cycle in the heavens, specifically in the troposphere. This sets the stage for living creatures in the sea and in the air. Genesis 1, 20 through 31. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. God created, there's our word, bara. God created, remember the definition? Something new that didn't exist before out of nothing. God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. There was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. Back to verse 21. God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves, with which the water swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. God created bara from the minutiae to the mega, the creatures of the sea and of the air. Again, bara, the act of creating something new for the first time out of nothing. These creatures are a special creative act of God, some of which have souls. Some categories of the creatures that God created on this day are actually described as nephesh in the Hebrew. They have souls. And what is a soul? In the Hebraic concept, the soul is mind, will, and emotions. That these animals can actually think. They have emotions. They have a will. They are in some ways like us. Made to relate to us and us to relate to them. In Job, we're told to go and learn from the soulish animals about who God is and who we are. It's an amazing thing that these soulish animals want to relate to us. Think of your dog or your cat, for instance, right? They want to relate. They want to please you. Teaching us that we also should relate to a higher being, just like they do, and seek to please the one that made us. After all, we're in his image. Let me read a passage from the psalmist's revelation of creation. Psalm 104, it's a beautiful read because, again, it's Hebrew poetry. And casts the vision of creation within that genre of literature, poetry, Hebrew poetry. And what you're going to find in Psalm 104 is Genesis 1 restated, okay? Just from a different author at a different time. Now I'm going to jump all the way down into the middle of this section, so you're only going to get a short piece of it. Here's the psalmist, 104, verse 24 through 30. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. These all look to you. You give them food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. Ready for this? 29 and 30. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. There's our word again, created, tied into day five in the creation of the creatures in the sea and then later on the land. This is very important for us to understand. He goes on to say, may the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. Now, I believe the evidence for these specialized creation events found in day five and day six, the creation of living things in the sea, on the land, in the air, these specialized creation events cued by the word bara in the Hebrew, these specialized creation events are found also in the natural record, as seen in the Avalon and Cambrian explosions, which, by the way, defy all macroevolutionist models. Even famed macroevolutionists are baffled by this. Let me give you just a few examples. Richard Dawkins, one of the most famed macroevolutionists, in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, wrote, quote, "For example, the Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest ones in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups, and we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history." Yeah, Richard Dawkins, baffled, admitting this makes no sense from a macroevolutionist model. Why? Because they all just kind of show up already in advanced stages. And macroevolution cannot accommodate that. It would have taken billions and billions and billions of years for the Cambrian explosion to have taken place. And yet it doesn't. It shows up so quickly with so much speciation that the macroevolutionists define it as an explosion of speciation, of which they're baffled and cannot explain based on their models. Gregory Gray, in the journal American Zoologist, stated the Cambrian quote unquote explosion of body plans is perhaps the single most striking feature of the Metazoan fossil record. The rapidity with which phyla and clasts appeared during the early Paleozoic, coupled with much lower rates of appearance for higher taxa since, quote, poses an outstanding problem for macroevolution. Says basically the same thing that Richard Dawkins says. We got problems. Kevin Peterson, Michael Dietrich, Mark McPeak, in the journal Bioessays, declared, quote, "Thus, elucidating the materialistic basis of the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more that we know about the event itself." As macroevolutionists, what they're saying is, the more we look into it, the bigger the problem grows. We're not solving it. We're beginning to realize it's unsolvable based on our macroevolutionist models. So, macroevolutionists are pretty much at a loss for the explosion of new life forms and speciation that seemingly comes out of nowhere. The more they study this, the more problematic it becomes for their macroevolutionary model of life on Earth. Conditions on the Earth at the time of the Avalon and Cambrian explosions are now today essentially the same as they were then, and yet the aggressive speciation rates have fallen to basically zero since the advent of human beings. So all of a sudden, all of this life, all these creatures just show up in advanced stages as if, well, they can't even go there. They can't, you know, I think it's Richard Dawkins who tried to say in explaining this, because his model didn't work, that aliens visited our planet, you know. I mean, you have to go there, right? There has to be a causal agent. God forbid, it's the God of the Bible, you know. So they'll give glory to aliens? You know, E.T.'s too ugly to be God, in my opinion. Okay. I'm sorry. That was mean. Phone home. I'm sorry. Okay, so. All this life, these creatures in the sea, you know, in the air, on the land, and if you understand the development and what shows up first and then what shows up later, and if you look at the extinction rates are just pretty scary too. But you have all this going on, and then at about the time that human beings show up, all of that just comes to an abrupt stop. It goes from this aggressive speciation to like zero almost overnight. It just like stopped, stunningly so. What's that all about? Well, they can't explain it. But I think the Bible does. The biblical model posits that God intervened many times, creating these life forms during these transitional periods of Earth's development. The extinction rates were high, but the appearance of new species replacing the extinct ones matched and at times surpassed the extinction rates. So we see all these animals showing up, and then we see them going extinct. And then we see new animals replacing those, only to go extinct, to see new ones replace them, only to go extinct. And the rate of the new ones surpasses extinction rates at different times in both the Avalon and the Cambrian explosions. I'm so fascinated by this. Sounds like Psalm 104. Verses 29 through 30. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. But when you send forth your spirit, they are created and you renew the face of the ground. Sounds like God is creating over and over and over what we see in the fossil record. It is mirrored in this intervention of God, creating new life forms as other ones go extinct. New ones are created. That's why the word bara is used on day five, and then in Psalms it explains it in a little bit more detail, filling in some of the background to what might just be the explanation that we see in the fossil record. I'll share more on this in a future class on the subject. I wanted to do like a 21-part sermon series, and no one gave me an encouragement. So, except my mother. But we'll do some work on this. It's for those that are interested. We'll have a great time. Okay, let's go to day six. Day six. Specific soulish mammals are introduced on day six. And humans are finally, quote unquote, created as the crowning glory of creation. Pick up the reading in verse 24. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things, the beasts of the earth after their kind." And it was so. God made the beasts of the earth after their kind and the cattle after their kind and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Then God said, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life, I've given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and morning the sixth day. Now, in creating humans, there is something original and brand new. Due to the word create, we know there's something new that did not exist before. But there's also something that apparently pre-existed that is also related to humanity. And this created part, well, it's related to our spirit. The pre-existing part that wasn't created seems to be in reference to our physical bodies. Genesis 2:7 says this, "Then the Lord God formed man of the dust from the ground." So he creates something new, but there's something old that's already been here. He takes the elements of the earth and forms that, and then he blows in this new thing that never existed before. And together we rise up as his representatives, made in his image. That's what it means to be an image bearer. We are representatives of God on earth, just as he is in heaven. God says, I'll take care of the universe. You know, there's a lot of fine tuning. Got to watch a lot of things, a lot of dials and stuff, you know, to like sustain the universe. He says, now I made you in my image, kids. You do that on the micro. I'll do the macro. You do the micro. So planet Earth is yours. I want you to rule and reign. Be a compassionate caregiver to the land, the environment, the animals, everything. Rule and reign. Govern it as I govern the universe. We are his image on earth, the image of the God who is in heaven, ruling and reigning over all things, seen and unseen. Now, due to the fall, sin entered in and poisoned us and marred that image of God. But regardless, even in the marring of sin, we still remain the image bearers of God. In humbling ourselves and embracing Jesus the Messiah as our Lord and Savior, we are being delivered from sin and its domain, healed from the effects of sin. We're being refined and conformed to the image of God. Let's move on. Day 7 and the Sabbath. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. 6 days. Take whatever view you want. Total of 6 hours, total of 72 hours, total of 144 hours, however you want to interpret day, because the Hebrew word yom allows for that. The science may be weighted in terms of which nuance is being used, but if you throw science out and just want to run with just the word, well, you can have whatever position you want, so read into it what you want to read into it. That's what we're all going to do. But I don't want us to get stuck on that. What I want us to realize is on the seventh day, something takes place, radically different. Thus, the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work, which God had created and made. The creator of all things, seen and unseen, very busy in all of his wisdom and strength and power and compassion and creativity, right? Bringing that which didn't exist into existence. Space, time, matter, energy. I mean, just, you know, the vastness and complexity and the refining of all that. He, on at the end of day 6, said, I'm done. Finished up with us and gave to us our little blue planet, said, this is it. It's good. It's good. Not perfect. Not perfect. But good. The perfect will come. But this is good. So on the seventh day, the creator ceases creating. And says, I'm going to rest from creating. Not because I'm tired, but because it's complete. It's good. So I'm going to rest. You'll notice that the phrase, and there was evening and morning, the seventh day, is missing. You'll find it in every other day, but not on the seventh. It's missing. What does that mean? It implies that this cosmic day of creation is more than 24 literal hours. It implies that it's ongoing. Isn't that interesting? Now, there's 3 main passages of Scripture that support this implication. Psalm 95, 7 through 11. Get a chance to read that. John 5, 16 through 18. And then Hebrews 4, verses 1 through 11. Each of these passages posit the idea that we're still in the seventh day. Thousands of years later, still in the seventh day, which makes the seventh day quite a bit longer than a 24-hour period. Also, the abrupt cessation of speciation from the creation of humanity, from the time that humanity's created, there's this abrupt cessation of speciation. This is ongoing proof, ongoing evidence that we are still in the seventh cosmic day of creation. He rested. So this whole creation of new speciation stops about the time that humans come on the scene. Well, it's because he rested from all of his work of creation. The extinction rates go on. Yeah, you know, all we have now is the dying out of all this speciation from the time humans showed up. Nothing to replace it. And everyone is shock and awe, like, what happened? And no one can explain it with their macroevolutionary models. The biblical text explains it. The creator stopped creating. That's why there's no new evidence today. They keep looking for it, and they can continue, but he's resting. The weekly seventh-day Shabbat, that cosmic day, that cosmic week, the weekly seventh-day Shabbat is analogous to that cosmic week of creation with its cosmic seventh-day rest. We have this weekly rest with our solar days that corresponds as analogous to work 6 days and rest. God says, okay, now you're on your planet, you got solar days. You work 6 days and rest, just like I worked 6 days and am now resting. Does that make sense? You're my imagers. Imitate me. I'm resting. You rest too. So we do on the micro what he's done on the macro because we are one with him. Made in his image. In addition to that, it is a sign. The weekly Shabbat is a sign, a memorial to him that he is the creator of all things seen and unseen. He is our Savior. He is our Redeemer. He is our Sanctifier. You're never going to figure all that out with just science. Neither will you figure out major parts of his glory without science. We need both. The Bible tells us that. The Bible itself says that the glory of God is seen in creation, that we can know God. It's the general revelation of who God is. The Bible is the specific revelation with the details. We need both. Finally, the weekly Shabbat is a type and shadow of the eternal spiritual rest that we have through faith in Yeshua the Messiah. So in summary and conclusion, God creates the universe out of nothing in our finite past. Science calls it Big Bang cosmology. Theologians, they call it, I forget the Latin word, I forgot the phrase, but he created all things, seen and unseen, out of nothing. The universe had a beginning. There's a causal agent. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who sent his son to die and redeem and restore his creation. We see this unfolding. We see the development, the fine-tuning of the universe, and specifically the earth on days 1 through 6. And then on day 7, we see this rest that God takes, and that this day actually covers thousands of years, representing the day of salvation. God said through King David, and then later the writer of Hebrews, "Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." David, in quoting this as a prophet, "Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." When did David say that? He said that what? How many years ago? He said, "Today, obviously there was a tomorrow. And the next day, today was still the same day. And then a week later, a month later, years, thousands of years later, it's still being said. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Well, how can that be if it's only a 24-hour period of time? It makes no sense. Unless it's in this fourth meaning, fourth nuance of the Hebrew word yom, which includes an epoch of time. So maybe we're still in the seventh day, represented as the day of salvation. That while it's still called today, the seventh day, we can put our faith in Yeshua, the Son of God, and be saved and find our eternal rest in him. 2 Corinthians 6, 1 through 2 says this. For he says, at the acceptable time, I listened to you, and on the day of salvation, I helped you. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Again, if day can only mean 24 hours, we're all up the river without a paddle. That day has already come and gone a long time ago. Unless, of course, the word day of salvation, and specifically day, yom, is a reference to an epoch of time. Every time we find this word day, we have to say, in what way is the author using it? Which nuance is he using of those four literal meanings? And only the context can determine that. We are the God imagers. We are the recipients of this great creation. And we are mandated to rule and sustain this creation compassionately and wisely. We are to be stewards and caretakers of this magnificent world and universe that we live within. It's our home. It's also home to all other living creatures and things. The next cosmic day is coming. It's represented in the last final festival of every year. It's called the last festival of the year, eighth day, the eighth day, the eighth day. Eight being the number of new beginnings, implying that God will create once again. Okay, back to work, right? With Jesus, all things will be reconciled to him, and then he is going to what? Replace this universe with its physics, with a new universe. He's going to create all over again a new universe and a new earth to replace the old. It begins a new cycle, if you will. Actually, the eighth day is described as Olam Haba, the age to come. And that age, unlike the other days, is actually without end. It uses the word olam to imply eternity. So that next day will come. He will create again. And we will experience and participate in a new recreation of the heavens and our earth. Heaven's great, but it's not the end of the world. I love that. It is great. It's the interim place that we all go to as we wait for the resurrection. Once we die, we go there. It's called paradise, Abraham's bosom. It's not our final destination. He came to save the whole man, the body too, not just what he created new, but that which he formed out of the earth. And he's creating a new earth, an immortalized earth. And he's going to take these bodies we have and immortalize them and glorify them. We're going to be spirit body together as he intended. So heaven is not the final destination. Earth is. It's our home. Jesus is coming home. He has an eternal physical body, glorified and immortalized. Of course he's coming back. Those bodies are really not designed for heaven. They're designed for heaven and earth. They're actually designed for heaven on earth. Heaven's coming to earth. The new Jerusalem comes down out of heaven to earth. We're not going from earth to heaven. Earth is our mother. Can I say that? He made us from the earth. He's recreating the earth. The earth will be immortalized. Our bodies will be immortalized. And heaven will merge with earth in the new Jerusalem that comes to us. And we will go through the realms of heaven and earth for all eternity. Our new home. This is what is represented in the eighth day. So, that concludes my series on creation. Now, I got some good news and some bad news. I decided to keep this series short and mostly in reference to the biblical text because it's so controversial once we take into consideration the natural record. Think Galileo. So I've kept it short on purpose. Now, because I decided to cut it short, people have asked me, what about the lunar Sabbath? I decided to move that topic to Torah Talk. I just finished an overview of the lunar Sabbath in my Torah Talk podcast, and you can get it now, graftedin.com. It is called Lunar Sabbatarians and Genesis 1:14. Highly recommend it. I also decided not to address the flat earth hypothesis in this series because the shock value among some of us due to truths and facts in the natural record is too controversial. However, if you're open to the facts of the natural record, you will find conclusive evidence. Conclusive. There's no guesswork here, people. It's real easy. You're going to find conclusive evidence on whether our Earth is flat or spherical. If you do not view the natural record as factual, then you have every right to believe whatever you want to believe about the shape of the Earth. But if the natural record has facts that can be proven, tested and proven, then you're going to enjoy this podcast. Shabbat shalom.
Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and his sons saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And we add, in the name of Yeshua our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panav alecha ve'yihunecha. Yisa Adonai panav alecha ve'asem lecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehilat Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat Shalom and Shavua Tov. Shabbat.